Dive deep into the heart of South Korea's most pressing stories with the weekly Korea Pro podcast. Hosted by Jongmin Kim and John Lee, this weekly 15-minute podcast is your source for thorough analysis on all things ROK. From intricate politics to dynamic cultural shifts, we cover it all. Tune in every Friday on KoreaPro.org, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Korea Pro Podcast, insight, not just information. Listeners, and welcome to the NK News Podcast. I'm your host, Jacko Zwetsuit, and this pre-interview chat is recorded on Tuesday, the 19th of March, 2024, and I'm here in the studio with Brian Betts. Brian, you haven't been on the show for a while, but welcome back.
Yes, good to be here.
And what I like about having you in as managing editor is you have an overview over everything that's going on the website. You know better than anybody what's coming down the pike, as they like to say in America.
Yes, that's coming down the pipe, right?
No, pike.
Is it down the pike?
Yeah, it's actually from Turnpike originally rather than Pipeline.
Ah.
But nowadays, thanks to folk etymology, people say both, pike right. And pipe.
Right. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So what is on your mind today?
Well, it's looking to be a pretty busy week. The last week in general has been pretty busy. As you probably know, the US ROK springtime drills were happening.
Yeah.
Those concluded last week. You know, there was a series of RK unilateral exercises and then joint exercises with the U.S. There was a lot of drills on attempting cruise missile launches from North Korea, on intercepting them, going through all the parts of the South Korea's three-axis system of preemptive strikes,
right.
missile defense, and retaliation in case of an attack.
So massive retaliation?
Massive punishment and retaliation, I believe, is the full name.
Right.
So that was happening throughout the week, but we also saw more responses from the North Korean side. Earlier in the drills, we saw them do...
they were too busy. They were doing construction and stuff.
Right. But then just a couple of days later, they turned around and actually did some responses. One was, you know, training to take out a South Korean guard post. Then last week they did some tank drills that Kim Jong-un joined.
Was there any footage of that? I mean, I saw the headline that Kim Jong-un rode on or in a tank. I missed the stills.
You'd have to look closely because if you look at the tanks, you'd see there's like a little kind of porthole in the front, in front of sort of the rotating turret part. And you can just see kind of Kim Jong-un sticking his head out.
Oh.
Sort of a funny image. So he was very much participating.
Okay.
So that happened over the weekend. North Korea held paratrooper drills in which they were sort of training under scenarios of sort of airdropping troops over the border. And then yesterday, we got a North Korean suspected ballistic missile launch. And this is how South Korea and Japan referred to it.
Why is it suspected?
Well,
what else
clear.
Could it be?
Yeah. So it was,
what are the options?
It was short range. The missiles flew for something like 10 minutes.
On a lofted or a normal trajectory?
I don't believe we'd got that information yesterday, but we found out today from North Korean state media that it was not ballistic missiles.
Oh.
It was multiple rocket launch systems, MRLS.
Okay.
600 mm. Those are quite large rockets. They sort of blur the line between artillery and missiles.
Right.
And they were fired in sort of salvos of six missiles at a time, at least from what we can tell from the photos.
Are these the kind of things that North Korea has been shipping to Russia? Do we know?
I'd have to double check on this particular this particular asset.
And what was the total number? So in salvos of six, but how many in total were?
Yesterday, South Korea said, I think they said three suspected ballistic missile launches, but then later in the day.
Yeah.
South Korea's defense minister said there was something sort of a little bit sort of funny about it that we sort of figured out, and they didn't reveal what that was at the time. Now that seems to have been that, it wasn't actually ballistic missiles. So we don't have an exact total. It may have been multiple salvos of six. It's not clear.
Okay.
But it does sort of, on the South Korean side, And the U.S. side, they've been doing these drills, intercepting cruise missiles, retaliation against doing strikes on the origin of a provocation, as they say it, attacking like ballistic missile launchers under these scenarios. Basically, the point being, anything you can fire at us, we can intercept, and then we're going to respond and punish you. So it's all about the deterrence. Well, North Korea is sending the same message, and they made that clear in today's state media report, saying, yeah, we fired these rockets because this is what we're going to do if you dare attack us, and we'll make you feel the pain.
Now, I don't expect you to have this answer to hand, but I always wonder at these in these kinds of circumstances, what kind of money is North Korea using? I mean, these are big. What was the measurement of the rockets? How many millimeters?
600.
Okay, so these are big things, and they're firing them in salvos of six. So that's a good few dollars that's being used there. Now, is it to test or is it just a show of strength? I mean, that's a lot of resource allocation, right? Rather than firing one, you fire bunches of six of them.
Right.
It seems like a lot.
Yeah, and that actually brings up an interesting other point is that in addition to sort of, you know, all this state media coverage of these drills, we see, on the other hand, in state media, a lot of emphasis on economic projects. And the message seems to be trying to counteract maybe the perception that the state is only interested in the military, trying to demonstrate we are caring for the well-being of the people. We kind of saw this earlier.
The old Byungjin line?
Well, yeah, the Byungjin line, but in the statement at the beginning of the Freedom Shield drills, when they're like, "Oh, our military is we're not warmongers. We're out there building stuff.
Right.
You know, we're working for the people. You know, we know that the state in North Korea mobilizes the military for construction projects and stuff like that." Well, over the weekend as well, on Saturday, Rodong Shinun reported that Kim Jong Un attended the groundbreaking ceremony for this big new greenhouse project.
Oh, yeah.
There have been several of these. This one is called the Kangdong General Greenhouse Farm. And state media was saying, oh, this is the world's biggest vegetable farm. And we built this by destroying airfields, important military bases, in order to build these farms for the welfare of the people. So that, you know, of course, the narrative there is we were making sacrifices on the military side to ensure people's food security, et cetera, et cetera.
Is North Korea trying to get into the Guinness Book of Records?
Well, I don't think the Guinness Book of World Records would recognize this particular record.
Why is that?
First of all, it's not even clear that this is the biggest vegetable farm in North Korea. They've opened these before, and if you can use satellite imagery and sort of compare the size.
Right.
And the new one is roughly the same size, perhaps even smaller, perhaps a little bigger, depending on how you calculate it, than ones they've built before.
Are they saying world's biggest vegetable farm, full stop, or world's biggest vegetable farm inside a greenhouse, or world's biggest greenhouse farm? What?
As far as I know, it's just world's biggest vegetable farm.
Because I'm sure.
But I think they're referring to greenhouse, greenhouse farm.
Because they've got to be bigger outdoor ones. I mean, just in the United States alone, you've got some, I don't know, some soybean fields or corn fields that go on for acres and acres, right? I mean, if you count that as a farm, then that's...
And it's not the world's biggest greenhouse farm either.
Okay.
There's one in Egypt we found that's at least four times, covers at least four times the area.
Was that built by North Koreans?
Not to my knowledge, but with so many North Korean laborers abroad, who knows?
Right. Well, and they did build a war museum in Egypt with a rotating diorama, I think modeled after the one in Pyongyang, the Great Fatherland War of Liberation Museum.
Right.
So, yeah, the biggest vegetable farm inside a greenhouse. It's nice to see North Korea starting some of these construction projects, but have they finished, for example, that general hospital in Pyongyang? Is that good to go now? Is that open?
Last we know, it is not open. There was a report maybe, I want to say in February, maybe early February, or earlier this year anyway, North Korea's premier visited and, you know, called for steps to open this up. But finally, it's been years.
Four years, I think. I think they started in the first year of the pandemic, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
It's a long, long time coming.
I think probably the difficulty we suspect is not so much the construction of the building, but outfitting it with medical tech. So, I mean, one thing we do know is that they have significantly increased medical imports during the pandemic. We did see trade go down a lot during the height of the pandemic, but they continued to prioritize medical imports, and the share of pharmaceuticals and medical equipment that it took up as part of their total trade notably increased. I don't think that was probably the really necessarily the technical equipment they needed for this particular hospital, but it does show at least that they're very much interested in that area.
All right, so that's close to opening, I guess, and then we've got this farm that they... So they finished that farm then, that greenhouse, have they? Or have they just kind of mapped it out?
Yeah, they finished it.
Okay.
Based on what we can see from the images they published in state media, and they're claiming to have finished it, yes.
Okay, and it's spring now, so I guess they could be growing all sorts of things in there, and that's good.
Yeah, it looked like a pretty swanky facility. Kim Jong-un walked around it with his daughter. There was some like fancy purple light thing going on that made for some interesting, striking images. You know, hydroponics and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And so, yeah, of course, they're emphasizing this is the state of the art and new scientific, and we're using science to care for the people. Yeah.
Makes me wonder also when the World Food Program or the Food and Agricultural Organization people will go back into Pyongyang and if they'll be taken on a tour of this place. Remains to be seen. Any idea how North Korea celebrated International Women's Day? I think that last week.
Yeah, that was right. So typically state media publishes a bunch of reports about how North Korean women are the most cared for in the world, promoting gender equality. But also, sort of interestingly, we saw some state media reports that were emphasizing that Kim Jong-un is the mother of the nation, who cares for the people like a mother cares for her child. So it's interesting because, you know, like a lot of communist states, sort of gender egalitarianism has been sort of a core part of the ideology from the beginning.
Yeah.
In practice, of course, what we see is women have very little role in government, in positions of power, but they, of course, have also seen their sort of status elevated through their participation in the markets, becoming breadwinners for the families and so on.
Interesting that Kim Jong-un is calling himself the mother. He's actually, ironically, he's following in the footsteps of his father in doing this. Because Kim Jong-il was also the mother of the nation.
Right.
Which I think I remember from a 2004 article in The Atlantic by B.R. Myers, who first revealed that to the world, or at least made that known in the English language speaking world. I mean, it was already known in North Korea, obviously. But yeah, so Kim Jong-un now also the mother of the nation.
Right.
All right. Well, happy Mother's Day, Kim Jong-un. All right. What are you looking forward to in the next week or so?
In the next week. You know, so there was a lot of talk about how North Korea was apparently relatively quiet around the U.S. ROK drills.
They hadn't done a missile launch
because they hadn't done missile launches.
Right.
They had been doing... The thing that overlooked was, of course, they were doing lots of military training.
Yeah.
And, of course, just a few days after the official end of Freedom Shield, they've done a missile launch or, you know, rocket launch.
Mm.
The timing of the North Korean reactions, I think sometimes it's a little delayed, so we may see more of that kind of testing in the next week or two. We're also seeing a continuation of military training on the southern side of the border. Just yesterday, or actually I believe it was last week on Friday, South Korea held some drills on practicing reinforcing the border islands of Baekgyong-do and Yeonpyeong-do.
So
if North Korea attacks, how are we going to get troops there kind of thing? So there could be more of that. We didn't see any U.S. strategic asset visits during the Freedom Shield.
Right, no B-52s, no nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, etc.
Right. I don't think they're going to come now, but who knows?
Yeah.
There could be trilateral stuff that happens now after the now that the bilateral stuff has wrapped up. Those are a few things I'll be looking for. The UN panel of experts report is expected to drop any day now, so we'll be looking for that and seeing whether they've turned up anything new in terms of sanctions violations. Yeah, I think those are a few things that I'll be looking at.
And we're about 4 weeks out from the Day of the Sun, Kim Il-sung's birthday. And I know that some people were expecting that perhaps Western tourists could be allowed into North Korea for the Day of the Sun. That looks increasingly unlikely with the deadline approaching.
We're monitoring it. We do know that the Russian tour company that's been leading the recent series of tours for specifically Russian travelers is planning a tour around the Day of the Sun.
Oh, okay.
And of course, it will have a different itinerary than the last three they've did because...
Right, won't be going to Masikryong.
Well, yeah. It's too warm for skiing.
Yeah.
And of course, if you're going around the Day of the Sun, you probably want to be in Pyongyang for those festivities.
Yeah, there may be a parade.
But so far, no indication yet that it will be anything other than Russian tourists who will be able to go for the holiday this year.
Yeah, Brian, so this year is the 10th year of the report by the Commission of Inquiry of the United Nations into the Human Rights Situation of the DPRK. Something that I've asked about before when I've talked about that topic is it now time for another one? And apparently some groups in South Korea or in the human rights space agree, right?
Yes, that's right. So last week on Friday, about 20 organizations that have a presence in something like 100 countries, they made a call at the current session of the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva for a update to the COI. It's the 10th anniversary, and there's a lot of sort of discussion happening right now about sort of what next, because the situation has not improved really in 10 years. If anything, it's probably gotten worse, particularly because the influence of the pandemic over the last 4 or so years. So a lot of discussion happening on what can be done now.
Yeah.
And in calling for an update, the groups emphasize a couple things. One is that a lot has changed in 10 years, so we need new information, better information. But also, you know, this report coming from the UN has a lot of power to raise awareness about the issue and to legitimize the work and efforts of human rights organizations that are documenting abuses, you know, collecting defector testimony, pursuing different forms of accountability and justice.
What would it take to have another inquiry or to have an update? Would that have to go through the Security Council, or how does that work?
So what I understand is no, it would not have to go through the Security Council, which is obviously important because most likely in the current environment, China and Russia would not approve something like that. From what I understand, it's a decision of the Human Rights Council to make. I don't know whether there is the sort of political will for it, but it's interesting that now at this juncture we've seen a lot of groups come together to make that call, and maybe in the coming months we'll see whether there's some momentum that builds around that or not.
Yeah, and that's also this week was the release of the Special Rapporteur's report, Elizabeth Salmon. Anything major new or surprising in there?
I have not taken a look yet.
Okay,
we'll have a story on that out by the time this is published.
Very, very soon. Okay. Yeah. But so this year, 2024, coming as it does 10 years after the release of the original COI report, is an important year, milestone, I guess, in the discussion on North Korean human rights. So yeah, that will be an issue that will come up multiple times during the year, and we'll certainly follow that trend.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Brian, for coming on the show and bringing us the latest updates. Listeners, stay tuned, because after this break, I will have an interview with Sheena Greitens about her recently published book on the North Korean diaspora and what their role is in moving the needle on things North Korean. Thank you.
Okay.
Welcome to a new realm of insights into the Korean Peninsula. At Korea Risk Group, we delve deep into the complexities of North and South Korea, offering bespoke analyses that empower decision makers. Whether you're in government, business, or academia, our tailored solutions provide clarity in an opaque region. Let our team guide your strategy with data-driven insights and on-the-ground intelligence. Step into a world of informed decision-making and visit careerriskgroup.com today. Welcome back, and welcome to our long interview. Today, I'm talking to Professor Sheena Chestnut-Greitens, who's Associate Professor at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, but she's now on leave to serve as a Visiting Associate Professor of Research in Indo-Pacific Security at the U.S. Army War College's Strategic Studies Institute. Find her on Twitter at Sheena Greitens and her own website at SheenaGreitens.com. We'll put links to that in the show notes. Welcome on the show, Sheena.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be with you.
And my apologies beforehand to both you and to our listeners. I may cough during the interview because I have a cold at the moment. So sorry about that.
Sorry to hear that. I hope that you mend swiftly and have an easy recovery.
Thank you. So congratulations on publishing a volume in the series Cambridge Elements in Politics and Society in East Asia, entitled Politics of the Korean Diaspora, about exiles from North Korea and their political engagement. Well done.
Thank you. It was a long time coming, and I'm delighted to be able to share it.
Good, good. Well, we'll talk a lot about that today. So what, first of all, what is the North Korean diaspora? How do you define it?
Yeah, you know, that was actually one of the early questions that I had to grapple with in writing the book, in part because a lot of studies about diasporas tend to take them on ethnic terms and to look at them in terms of a Korean diaspora. And so part of what the book wanted to argue is that if you look at this from the perspective of North Korean emigres themselves, that they actually see themselves as somewhat distinctive. So, for example, some of the survey data in the book ask North Koreans how they identify themselves when they're in the United States. And it's usually a North Korean American or a North Korean in the United States. And so that North part is a very important part of their identity. So the book really looks at the experiences of people who have left North Korea as a sort of a distinct layer in the broader Korean diaspora worldwide. And I was interested in it because that diaspora has only relatively recently emerged in global politics and has some, I think, distinctive features, but has also been quite influential despite being relatively small. And so I was interested in that phenomenon.
Wait, when you count the diaspora, do you also count North Koreans who are allowed to live overseas by the government, such as diplomats, traders, students, academics, and members of the state security ministry? Or are we only talking about those who are fleeing from the regime and leaving, so to speak, without permission?
So the book focuses more empirically on that second group, the people who leave without permission. But one of the things that the book actually talks about is that the composition of the North Korean diaspora has changed over time. So during the Cold War, the North Korean diaspora was largely a regime-affiliated diaspora projected by the state, sent abroad for various foreign policy and economic purposes, diplomats, trading companies, people engaging with Juche friendship societies and things like that. So it was very much aligned with the regime and its interests, often deliberately organized and sent abroad by Pyongyang, and organized in what we would in political science call a corporatist structure. So groups that are vertically responsible back to the regime in Pyongyang. What happened with the end of the Cold War is that the composition of the North Korean community outside of North Korea really changed and became much more significantly composed of these people who had left North Korea either in search of greater political freedom or sometimes just in search of economic survival or opportunity to work and to send money back. Not all of them intended to leave permanently, although some ended up doing so. And so the composition of the diaspora changed, as did its political relationship with the North Korean homeland and the government of North Korea. And that in turn, I think, really shifted how the North Korean government viewed the diaspora, the political challenges that came with having its people scattered around the world abroad. It really changed how the regime then thought about what it needed to do to manage its diasporic presence. Not a question unique to North Korea by any means, but there really hadn't been, you know, we've had some really interesting books and work on the North Koreans who the state has sent abroad, whether that's formal foreign policy or trading companies or things like that. We really hadn't had a full look at that second group of people who had left mostly since the end of the Cold War and since the arduous march and crisis in North Korea in the mid-90s. So I wanted to keep most of the focus there, but the diaspora really is composed of both. It's just shifted over time.
Okay, so that second group there of people who have left sort of without permission, the people who are fleeing, sometimes called defectors or refugees, how large is it and how dispersed is it around the world?
So the majority of North Koreans who have left and formally resettled somewhere are in South Korea. That community is about 34,000 people, as I imagine you and many of your listeners know. There are a large number in China. It's very difficult to estimate the size of that population. But then there's also an increasingly globalized and globally dispersed community of North Korean emigres. And that was actually one of the things that really motivated my early interest in the book from an academic perspective. There's kind of a human interest dimension to how the book originated. But the academic part really came from realizing that if you look at, for example, UNHCR statistics, which the book goes through in one of the early chapters, that more and more North Koreans were choosing to file for asylum or try to resettle in locations beyond South Korea. And so there was an increasingly global element to the North Korean diaspora beyond the peninsula. And so I was, you know, interested in that. Again, the numbers are really pretty difficult to measure because people drop in and out of the UNHCR statistics as they get citizenship or permanent residency. So we're still talking about a very small diaspora by global comparative standards.
But yeah, I think if we took out the sort of floating population in China, some of whom, as you say, are not intending to leave North Korea forever. So before COVID and now perhaps after COVID, although it's much more difficult because of the border tightening, but it was more of a fluid population in China. So if we bracket them aside and we've got the 34 or so thousand in South Korea, I'm guessing that the rest of the world is probably not much more than a couple of thousand. So we're still having no more than 40,000 in total at best. Is that large enough to be considered a diaspora? Normally, when we think of the Jewish diaspora, the Chinese diaspora, the Armenian diaspora, they're quite large in number. This is a small number, isn't it?
It is a comparatively small number. You know, there's not really a sort of a size threshold for thinking about the diaspora. We tend to actually consider communities more in terms of whether or not they think of themselves as part of a common political community and whether or not they have some ongoing, what scholars would call a homeland orientation. So some relationship or orientation or connection with the North Korean homeland. So yeah, it's definitely one of the smaller populations. Mm. But that actually, for me, was interesting partly because despite being really, really small by comparative standards, they've had a pretty big impact, I think, on global politics. And I found that really interesting and worth investigating.
Now, how do you avoid the danger of using this one word, diaspora, to describe a quite disparate group of individuals and families, each with their own stories about life in North Korea and circumstances in North Korea and leaving North Korea? There could be a danger in trying to lump that together as a single monolithic group. How do you avoid that?
I don't think there's a way to come up with a perfect terminology. So we see this in Korean, we see this in English, the term defector, refugee, migrant, each of these have specific political connotations. And so I was actually trying in using the word diaspora to broaden the aperture a little bit and talk about people who had left North Korea and were now located abroad, whether that sort of regardless of motivation, regardless of generation, whether it was them or their descendants that the book was looking at. And so, you know, I don't think there's a perfect word. The book talks a bit about, you know, what I mean when I talk about a diaspora and why I think that this is a useful term. In this case, I think it's analytically useful because it lets us ask some interesting and different questions about this global population of North Koreans that especially, you know, I think we can get a little bit more curious and interested in some of what makes the North Korean diaspora either distinct or what people might have in common with other transnationally dispersed populations that still have some communal identity and orientation toward a homeland. Mm-hmm. For example, why are North Koreans relatively politically more engaged, which is one of the questions that the later sections of the book tackle. We might not know that was interesting if we didn't have any baseline for comparison. And so I think the term diaspora facilitates some of these comparisons that maybe tell us some things we might not have realized are either unique or interesting about the population of North Korean emigres around the world.
You mentioned earlier their outsized impact. So what's the impact that this group has made on world affairs?
I think the biggest impact has been on global human rights advocacy and policies toward the DPRK itself. One of the biggest successes that the North Korean diaspora had was in really helping galvanize the movement that resulted in the UN Commission of Inquiry in 2014 into human rights and conditions in the DPRK. That became possible in part because there were communities of North Koreans in a couple of key locations around the world who had linked up with other advocacy groups and supporters of North Korean emigre activism. And without those anchoring communities in places like Japan or the US or the UK, it's difficult, you know, counterfactuals are always tricky, but it's difficult to see how the Commission of Inquiry would have taken shape in the way that it did, or certainly had the kind of evidentiary basis and impact that it did. The evidentiary strength of the report really rests on testimony that was provided by several hundred people across hearings that were spread out over a number of different countries. And I think the North Korean emigre community and the diaspora really made that possible.
And now what about in South Korea? What impact has this group had on South Korean government policies or politics?
You know, in both the South Korean case and in a few other cases around the world, whether it's Japan or Canada, one of the primary impacts of members of the North Korean diaspora has been in advocating for their own group rights and welfare. So kind of classic interest group politics in a sense, right? That's sort of the bucket that a comparative politics scholar would put that in. So, for example, in Japan, debates over North Korean returnee policy, but also policy toward abductees. So Celeste Arrington and others have some great work on the way in which the debate over abductees got looped in with the policies toward North Koreans in Japan themselves. Similarly, in Canada, some of the biggest advocacy has been focused simply on getting the right to resettle in Canada as a pilot program that was passed about 2 years ago. So often some of the biggest domestic advocacy successes, I bracket South Korea here, but outside of the South Korean context, mm-hmm. have actually been in getting the right to resettle in that third country, because the combination of sort of South Korean nationality and constitutional law often actually precludes North Koreans from seeking asylum or refugee status in a number of third countries. So changing that has been a significant focus of some countries' advocacy.
Now, here in South Korea, it seems that the political impact of the North Korean diaspora ebbs and flows according to who's the president here. I recalled that during the times of President Norman-Hyun and Moon Jae-in, defectors were discouraged from speaking publicly and engaging politically, whereas when there's a conservative president in power, that changes quite a bit. Is that something that comes up in your research?
It does. The role of North Korean communities in South Korea in inter-Korean relations does tend to ebb and flow depending on the domestic politics, and in particular, the orientation of the president and the administration. So, for example, there was a lot more effort to regulate and exert control on some of the defector-led advocacy during the Moon Jae-in period, whereas what we've seen so far from the Yoon administration has been some focus on domestic programs aimed at changing and improving North Korean resettlement and life in South Korea, but also a global focus on making this part of what the Yoon administration has called values-based diplomacy. And that includes raising, for example, the situation of North Korean defectors in China that the ROK foreign minister raised with his Chinese counterpart not too long ago. That is actually a relatively unusual step in terms of the history of South Korean policy and advocacy on this issue. And it does, it tends to vary with whoever is in the presidency.
Now, one thing that diaspora groups sometimes do around the world is create governments in exile. And I wonder, are you aware of any serious or organized attempts to set up a government in exile for a future North Korea after the current system changes or goes away?
Not in the way that we've seen, for example, among the Tibetan diaspora. The book talks a bit about the form that North Korean activism and oppositional activity has taken. It's largely been human rights advocacy, in some cases, in advocacy in South Korea on inter-Korean relations and unification policy. But there has been relatively little, I would say, of two things that we sometimes see among other diasporas. One is an attempt to establish a sort of completely parallel government in exile, and the other is armed opposition or attempts to support some kind of more militant opposition domestically in country. North mm-hmm. Korea, I think, is simply too closed for the latter. And I think some of North Korea's own policy, as the book goes through, has been aimed at trying to keep North Koreans who've left and gone abroad from connecting and providing political support to those who might remain in North Korea. So I think North Korean diaspora management policy is aimed at trying to prevent those ties from forming and being institutionalized. But that also means that, you know, we haven't seen a lot of effort to set up a completely parallel government in exile. What we have seen is discussion about the role that North Koreans might play in future leaders of a reunified Korea if and when that day comes. Mm-hmm. A lot of discussion about that. But one of the questions I was most interested in is, if you come from and grow up in one of the world's most authoritarian political systems, how do you think about what it's like to be a citizen in a democracy like South Korea, the United States, the UK? Because that does have some bearing on what kinds of political leadership and political system North Koreans might form if given the choice, and what role exiles would play and folks who've remained in North Korea throughout this time would play as well.
Now, I've heard it said that North Koreans bring their divisions with them when they become part of the diaspora. For example, those from Pyongyang or the elite classes tend to only mix with others from the same circles. Have you found that to be true?
You know, I've definitely heard and seen some of that in some of the research I've done in South Korea, where the population is somewhat larger. One of the things that the book tried to do is spend a little bit more time looking at places outside of South Korea. So there's some really good scholarship on the experiences and political beliefs and behavior and sort of social integration and history of North Koreans in South Korea. And so in this book, I was trying not to sort of duplicate or reinvent the wheel on that scholarship, but kind of build and extend on it by looking at North Koreans in the United States or the UK and this more globally oriented dimension of the diaspora. And in those cases, at some times and in some places, you see some of these divisions persist or replicate themselves. But at some times the communities are actually too small. And you're literally talking about disagreements of personality. So it's hard to tell whether someone's from Pyongyang or two people that just might not get along particularly well. I will also say that, you know, one of the sort of surprising things to me in the book is that actually sometimes that disagreement was productive. So people who had different advocacy, who had sort of pretty sharp clashes sometimes about what the right advocacy strategy was, or who didn't want to focus on a particular issue or in a particular way, might say, okay, well, I'm not interested in doing this sort of political freedom kind of I really want to focus on gender-based rights or gender-based violence, and would sort of want to broaden the advocacy. And that was actually really productive because it gave the North Korean human rights movement or advocacy movement often different bases of support, particularly around the world, and actually in some ways contributed to a more diverse and broader range of political support, really, for North Korean advocacy and political involvement that wasn't particularly partisan or limited to a specific political issue. And so some of these things that people might have seen as negative or frustrating during the process actually turned out over the long term to be somewhat helpful for the overall advocacy effort. And I found that a little bit counterintuitive and interesting about the process.
Now, how has the government in Pyongyang tried to reach out and manage or control the North Korean diaspora?
It's a great question. And, you know, this book came out at a time when we're having, I think, more conversations about the phenomenon of transnational repression than at any point that I can remember as a scholar who spent a lot of time thinking about how non-democracies work and what they do in the world. So I would say that the North Korean approach is broadly composed of three baskets. One is that North Korea tries to dissuade people from leaving. So even compared to other autocracies around the world, it goes to pretty extraordinary effort to stop people from leaving the DPRK. And that, I think it's worth noting how unusual North Korea is, even for an autocracy on that spectrum. The second thing that the North Korea does pretty actively is try to discredit people who do leave. They try to discredit people in international fora like the UN. You see that in the pushback that the North Korean government mounted against the Commission of Inquiry and the defectors who participated or testified to the commission. But we also see that in some of the domestic propaganda and messaging that comes out of the regime, where there were some individual documentaries made about high-profile North Koreans. Sometimes it's just category referring to them sort of as a group or collectively as human scum or human trash. But sometimes there are very specific targeted efforts to discredit people biographically if they've become particularly prominent spokespeople. And then the third pillar is really trying to deter people who have left from engaging in organized political opposition. That can take any sort of number of forms. It could be a threatening phone call to somebody who's not very high profile, but living in South Korea, to stop them from trying to contact family or bring family out, or maybe try to pressure them to return. Or it can take, in extreme forms, you know, a sort of extreme form of transnational repression would be something like assassination. Compared to, again, a sort of an average authoritarian regime, especially for its size, North Korea has an unusual number of assassinations that have been attributed to it. The sort of high profile case, recent case, is Kim Jong-nam in a Malaysian airport. But there are other incidents that have been attributed to the North Korean government, either officially or unofficially, for people who are either helping defectors escape in China or along the Chinese border, or even in South Korea itself. And so those are basically the three pillars: the sort of dissuading people from leaving, mm-hmm. discrediting them when they do, and then actively trying to deter them, including repressively if the regime feels like that's necessary.
Now, I read a book a few years ago about the situation in East Germany, which certainly had the former East Germany that has some parallels here. I mean, East Germany made fleeing the Republic a crime. It's called Republiksflucht, which is a crime punishable by months or even years in prison. So that's quite similar to North Korea. But also, there was a far larger number of East Germans who defected mostly to West Germany. And in that book, the techniques were described that the East German government used to try to convince its defectors to come back to East Germany, usually by leveraging their family relationships. And those that did come back often ended up in pro-regime propaganda, trying to dissuade other people from fleeing in the future. So what about North Korea's efforts? Does it do similar things?
There was a period where North Korea seemed to do a lot of that, particularly in the early years of the Kim Jong-un regime. There were a number of what we call redefector press conferences, people who'd gone back to North Korea, and then press conferences, or in some cases, sort of visited various towns to speak about why they had come back and how it was a terrible idea to leave. You know, we don't really know in a number of these cases why people decided to go back to North Korea. There is, in many cases, a strong suspicion that they were coerced. There's a term China scholars use called relational repression, which is where you put pressure on or threaten someone's family to get them to demobilize and not engage in political opposition. Because for most people, it's one moral calculation to put themselves at risk. Yeah. It's another thing to jeopardize the safety of elderly parents or grandparents or siblings or children. And so it really changes the sort of the moral calculus of political opposition at the individual level. Mm. But for North Koreans, these redefector press conferences were, again, a really notable feature. There were a bunch clustered together in the first few years of Kim Jong-un's time in power. They've been less frequent. There are still reports of North Koreans going out and who've returned and trying to discourage people from leaving and talking about how grateful they are that North Korea welcomed them back. But it's interesting that phenomenon kind of rose and then subsided a bit.
Mm, yes. Now, under the South Korean constitution, North Koreans are instantly eligible for South Korean citizenship if they can prove their bona fides. So but you found that this can be more difficult than it first appears. Why is that?
Yeah, so, you know, the part of the early research for the book was actually going through either via interviews or memoirs or other testimony and looking at what happened when North Koreans tried to get to South Korea. And, you know, we hear this phrase automatic citizenship quite a bit. Mm-hmm. It does not feel automatic from the perspective of a North Korean who might be stuck somewhere in China and is trying to access help. First, because at times the South Korean government has been worried about geopolitical blowback. If it opens the door of a diplomatic facility to North Koreans, that will become a regular phenomenon, whether it's in China, Vietnam, somewhere else in Southeast Asia. And so sometimes has been reluctant to offer assistance, certainly actively, but sometimes even when North Koreans come and seek help. And there are a number of cases that I documented from various sources where North Koreans had asked for help and been essentially turned away, usually with some grounds of like, look, we can't antagonize host country X for this or that broader strategic reason.
Right.
You know, the issue is that if you are an automatic citizen, then you are entitled to certain rights and assistance when you're abroad and entitled to some entry into South Korea. Again, there's this, you know, requirement to prove your identity or status, which can be very difficult for North Koreans who often have a good reason not to carry papers identifying them as North Korean in, for example, China, if they're there for a long time. And so even the sort of fact that you have to prove who you are to the South Korean state has a perfectly understandable security rationale. But from the perspective of North Koreans, that makes citizenship actually feel contingent and highly conditional, and not at all automatic. And so the book tries to just unpack what that looks like at a couple different stages of the migration and resettlement process, you know, how much effect that has on North Koreans then either deciding to stay in South Korea or potentially go migrate onward to another location is really hard to tease out, partly because the numbers aren't big. But it is a feature of the resettlement process that I wanted to call attention to, because this phrase automatic citizenship makes it sound easier than it might look from the perspective of a North Korean who's trying to make the very difficult journey to get to South Korea and feels like they're running into a lot of obstacles and challenges in that process.
Let's talk a little bit about those refugees who first come to South Korea and are accepted here and then choose after a while to leave it and find a third country to go and live in. Often, or usually, I think my understanding is when they claim asylum in that third country, those claims are rejected because they've already applied for and received asylum in South Korea. Is this a problem? And what would be the best solution if it is a problem?
So I think that, you know, North Koreans who go to South Korea, become South Korean citizens, yes, at that point, they are active holders of usually South Korean passport or identity card and are not eligible for citizenship elsewhere. But that's actually not the only reason why North Korean asylum and refugee claims get rejected abroad. And I was really surprised by this when I was doing the research for the book, that there were, you know, a number of cases and a number of countries that started by saying, okay, look, if you've already gone and gotten South Korean citizenship, you've actively availed yourself of this available citizenship. You've made your choice. That's, you know, you only kind of get one chance to choose here. But there was actually another category that I found really striking, and that was people who hadn't gone to South Korea first, who made a deliberate decision to try to go directly to another place because they wanted to, or that's where they could get to. So one of the cases that was most striking to me, this occurred in Canada, this occurred in the UK, was a husband and wife who had gone from China to the UK directly, never going to South Korea. They had two children in the UK, and the UK court said, well, there is no person who's just a North Korean citizen. You are also sort of by definition under South Korean law, also South Korean citizen. And so therefore, you're going back to your country. And this was a country that in practical terms, this family had never set foot in, including two children who had been born in the UK. And I just found that really striking that because the South Korean government claims all of the territory of North Korea, the way that these laws intersect gave the UK the idea that it was sending them back to the country of their citizenship, even though, again, in practical terms, it was a country that they had never been to. And that gets to this distinction between the sort of the Korean diaspora and the specifically North Korean diaspora, because from the perspective of a North Korean, that didn't make a lot of sense, right? I'm not going back anywhere. I'm going to a completely different political, economic, social, cultural environment. Yes, it's Korean, but there are these major fundamental differences in going to South Korea. It's not really going back anywhere. And so that seemed really just important to capture. And again, that was part of the motivation for writing the book, because it seemed like something that wasn't recorded anywhere, that seemed important to the people who were living these lives, that was worth drawing some attention to and making visible.
Do you know what the end result of that case in the United Kingdom was?
The family went back to South Korea.
Wow. Okay. So how do members of the North Korean diaspora understand their new roles as people living in a democratic society? What are the aspects of a democratic society that appeals to them, that they value the most? And it also includes the question of what you raised earlier, is why is their political engagement so high? So talk about that a little bit, if you would, please.
Yeah, so one of the moments that was most striking that really stuck with me over the course of writing this book was actually talking to a woman who was ethnically Chinese, but who'd grown up in North Korea and who went back and forth between China and North Korea for work quite a bit. And we were standing on the Chinese side of the China-North Korea border, looking across into North Korea. And she said to me, well, you know, you and I are free and the people in North Korea are not. And China was somewhat different 10 years ago, right? It was very early in Xi Jinping's tenure, if not maybe even a few years before he became the president and party leader of the CCP. But it was still sort of jarring to me as a, you know, Western, relatively young student to hear Chinese and American people grouped together as equally free by implication, right? And so that really got me interested in sort of how North Koreans, once they left, perceived the Chinese political system, American political system, if they had contact with it, South Korean democracy. And we have some survey data on how North Koreans in South Korea view democracy sort of what the patterns of political participation are, we had almost no data on North Koreans who don't go to South Korea. So there are these, so we don't know how much of this is an artifact of going specifically to South Korea versus going to a democracy writ large. And so I did a survey of North Koreans in the United States and, you know, found a couple of really interesting things. First, that North Koreans, I would say, ascribe to what we might call a civic or even a civil libertarian almost conception of citizenship, where one of the biggest responsibilities of a democratic government is to prevent government abuse or overreach in terms of its behavior to citizens. And the right to be protected from government abuse is really important to a lot of North Korean respondents. Now, you might look at that and say, okay, well, that makes sense because they came from a system where there was no real constraint on government power and it was very abusive or repressive for many of the people who left, right? And many of them have direct experience with government repression. But they also had experience with the socioeconomic system, the public distribution system failing, with the socioeconomic needs of citizens not being met by the government. And they didn't have the same sense that this was equally important for being a democratic citizen or the job of a democratic government. And so there's this really strong emphasis on civil liberties, on the right to be sort of protected and have one's freedom and rights protected. There are a couple of other interesting things, but that was one of the first things that jumped out. Democratic participation is also really important. So in both South Korea and the United States, the baseline voting rate among North Koreans who are eligible to vote is higher than the average voter population.
Could be argued that that's a holdover from their time in North Korea when voter participation rate was equally high.
It might be. You know, when I talked to people, I got the sense that it was more, I had to participate in this as kind of a charade before, but now it means something. And so now I'm going to do it and be excited about it. The other thing that was quite interesting that people reacted to a lot was being given an identification card, whether it was South Korea or an American passport, that something that marked you as a citizen and enabled you to claim sort of protection, but also status as a citizen of, you know, again, in the survey, it was really the United States, was really meaningful to people. And I thought that was really interesting. So we knew in South Korea that people who sort of had a strong ethnic affinity or communal identity attachment to their community also were more likely to participate in things like voting. But what was really interesting about the respondents in the United States is that many expressed a really strong communal attachment to North Korea or to the Korean Peninsula or to being Korean. But that existed simultaneously with a really strong civic attachment to the United States and pride in being American. And so those two things could actually coexist together, which we just didn't know because nobody ever tried to look at that and look at those two different forms of identity and how they might sit next to each other in a non-Korean multi-ethnic setting. So it was interesting to see what that actually looked like when you switch to a setting like the United States.
Yeah.
So yeah, those were some of the really interesting things. And you know, we have a little bit of data on how active various immigrant or diaspora groups are in the United States. And usually between sort of one third and one sixth of a diaspora community is politically active, depending on how you measure political activity. And the statistics for North Koreans show a much higher rate of political engagement. So I found that interesting as well, specific to the United States.
Talking about the United States, have you observed any tensions between recently arrived members of the North Korean diaspora on the one hand and Korean Americans who have been away from Korea for decades and often have a more, some of them have a more softline approach towards engagement with North Korea and peacemaking with the government in Pyongyang?
Yeah, that was really an interesting part of the book as well. First, you know, we asked questions about how often people had encountered discrimination. And I was doing this survey in 2021 during, you know, the first year to just over a year after the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic, when there was a lot of concern about anti-Asian discrimination and hate crimes and things like that. And even in that environment, there was actually a noticeably lower fraction of people who self-reported discrimination. And of the people who did report experiencing discrimination in the United States relative to South Korea, they were more likely to sort of specifically explain in the qualitative responses that it came from either a South Korean that they'd encountered or a Korean American, which was both interesting and a little bit troubling.
Yeah.
But politically, this does take the form of occasionally there are tensions over who gets to speak for either the Korean people or mm-hmm. the North Korean people. And again, this gets to this question of the difference between a North Korean diaspora or this right. a broader Korean diaspora. You see this with groups like, for example, the Peace on the Korean Peninsula Act. There have been a couple, I think, versions in two different Congresses now that have been proposed. And you have groups like Women Cross DMZ, which is Korea Peace Now. So has members who are from the Korean American community whose politics are leftist or progressive. I think Women Cross DMZ has a North Korean member on its leadership team, but not a North Korean emigre or refugee or defector.
Oh.
And so if you think about crossing the DMZ, right, to exclude the people who've left North Korea, if you're trying to engage in a peace building process, seems like it might be somewhat problematic to leave out this group that's chosen to leave. But the sort of practical parts of that process aside, what was interesting to me was this sort of, you know, debate over who got to speak for yes. and who was an authentic representative of the people of North Korea.
Yeah.
And both, you had two different groups with very different politics claiming one on a more sort of pan-ethnic, pan-Korean identity, and the other very specifically invoking credibility based on lived experience inside yeah. North Korea that led them to a different view. And right. I found the way that was framed and the tension that created to be really interesting.
And just on that point of the question of who gets to speak, I'm also interested in whether you found a sense among some North Korean refugees that democracy and a liberal society, it's all too confusing and chaotic. You know, are there those who miss the easy certainties and clear answers of living in a state where one-hearted solidarity is the eternal catchphrase?
That's not something that I've encountered a lot. There may be, you know, some folks, and certainly among groups in Eastern Europe and post-communist society, there's a current of that thinking and that nostalgia that shows up very prominently in survey data in varying forms in different post-communist settings in Europe.
Yes. Yeah, it was particularly prevalent in the United Germany, you know, those East Germans who felt nostalgia for the old East. Yeah, that was something that I noticed when I studied that. So yeah, but you haven't noticed that among the North Koreans so much.
Not as much. I think certainly there's disillusionment with expecting mm-hmm. something in South Korea that maybe is vague, but the reality turns out to be more complicated and challenging. And then sometimes what you see among people in the United States is simply that they're a little bit overwhelmed. So kind of two different questions, I think, embedded in what you asked. One is about nostalgia for North Korea.
Yep.
The other is about whether people feel overwhelmed by the demands or the differences of the society and the life they get dropped into. And certainly, I mean, I'm trying to spend a little bit of time getting some of these survey results in front of different advocacy organizations and the State Department and some of the refugee resettlement organizations. Because you do see an element of that among North Koreans in the United States, that there's a real struggle to gain sufficient English proficiency to get a better job. But if you're busy working a job, you don't have time to study English to get a better job. And so there's this sense of feeling either kind of overwhelmed or a bit trapped among some of the survey respondents. And so thinking about what might be done to better assist people who are already in the United States, and I will add who almost to a person wanted to file for American citizenship as soon as possible. And again, almost all who voted if they could, it was not a lack of sort of desire to integrate or desire to become American. It was really, you know, more practical hurdles. Yeah. And then also real, rather than sort of maybe nostalgia for North Korean life, a sense of disruption, loss of community, being lonely. I don't know that I would quite call it nostalgia, but certainly that sense of a loss of community among people who lost their hometowns, who've lost contact with their families, who've often struggled to make social connections because of the way the United States does individual refugee resettlement. I think that those are very real challenges for people in the United States. Again, you're talking about a couple hundred people, mm-hmm. but they are here, they are in the United States, and I would like to understand what their experience is and how to make it better.
Now, I'm down to the last question. In your book, you map out three roles for members of the North Korean diaspora. First of all, they're witness to past abuses. And then secondly, they're representatives of voiceless North Korean people in the present. And thirdly, they're stakeholders in a North Korean future. And on that, particularly on that last note there, I'm wondering, what if North Korea's system and government do not change in the next 50 years and most or all of the current North Korean diaspora die without ever seeing significant transformation? What will be their legacy?
Yeah, wow, that's a really difficult and heart-wrenching question, because it, just at a human level, I think that would be a tragedy multiple times over for each individual who's affected in North Korea or outside of it. You know, I think your question raises something really important, which is that the book in some ways actually is really cautionary about the potential for diasporas to affect political change. Some of the case studies we have on how diasporas can be politically influential are drawn from the Arab Spring, where there's a lot more social media connectivity, there's a lot more diasporic connectivity to activist groups in the homeland, and there's more political opportunity for advocacy and organization, where there's an opening that occurs of a kind we haven't seen yet in North Korea. And so I wanted to set realistic expectations for how hard it is as a diaspora to affect full-on regime transformation, and to try to focus on some other forms of political advocacy and change that might be more realistic in the near term. I guess, you know, for me, I come back to the human element, right, of this and the human stakes, which is that I don't think we can set the bar that North Korea has to transform in a specific way on a specific timeline for the efforts of people who work for change and greater freedom or greater contact between separated families. You know, that somehow that doesn't count unless North Korea democratizes in the next 10 years. I think we need to allow space for and attribute meaning to a lot of these smaller, more incremental changes or things that impact and shift individual people's lives, not just sort of wholesale change on a massive scale, which I know a lot of people are working for and hoping for and praying for, depending on their particular politics and orientation and belief about what causes political change. But I guess I wanted in some ways to draw attention to the legacies and to the change that's been created, even, you know, in the moment we're in right now, and the really how that's been done again in incredibly difficult circumstances. I don't know if that quite answers your question, but I think it's a question of scale and where we sort of choose to focus our attention and sense of what's meaningful in.
Yeah, looking at things on the human level, keeping it on the human level, yeah. That's a good place for us to end today. Thank you once again, Professor Sheena Chestnut-Greitens, for coming on the show. Listeners, you can look out for her book in the Cambridge Elements in Politics and Society in East Asia series. It's called Politics of the North Korean Diaspora. It's a slim volume, but there's a lot of stuff in it, so check it out. And you can find her on Twitter at Sheena Greitens and also at her own website, sheenagreitens.com. Thank you once again.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Get to the core of Korean insights with KoreaPro's exclusive Seoul event series. Join us for gatherings that bring you face-to-face with key opinion leaders, journalists, and experts on South Korean affairs for dinner, drinks, and more. Engage in deep discussions on political, economic, and social issues at special venues across Seoul. From dinners with KoreaPro editors to insightful conversations with renowned guests, each event promises a unique blend of expertise and networking. Immerse yourself in the pulse of Korea. Register now at events.koreapro.org. Ladies and gentlemen, that brings us to the end of our podcast episode for today. Our thanks go to Brian Betts and Alana Hill for facilitating this episode, and to our post-recording producer genius, Gabby Magnuson, who cuts out all the extraneous noises, awkward silences, bodily functions, and fixes the audio levels. Thank you, and listen again next time.